Hello there. My name is Julia Serrano, and I'm a writer and gender activist. And I'm here today speaking with Victor Silverman and Susan Stryker about their new film, Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria. So basically, the film depicts the first collective militant queer resistance. And it was a story that actually got lost in history and has sort of been resurrected very recently. I figured I would start by just asking you how you came across it and began to put the pieces together, the incident.
I came across the story about 10 years ago now when I was working on a book called Gay by the Bay, A History of Queer Culture in the San Francisco Bay Area. And when I found this document that described a riot where transgender street prostitutes fought back against the police at an all-night cafeteria here in San Francisco, a place called Compton's Cafeteria in the Tenderloin, in 1966. And it struck me as a really odd story because I'd never heard that particular story. You know, you hear about Stonewall, you know, which happened in 1969, which was, you know, supposedly the event that kicked off the gay liberation struggle. But this riot involving tranny prostitutes in San Francisco was, you know, 3 years earlier, and, you know, nobody had ever heard of it. And just, you know, over time, over a couple of years, you know, started, you know, piecing together little bits of information, and, you know, was surprised to see that, you know, to learn that this riot did happen as it was described in that document, and that it was a really significant event in transgender history and in queer history and in the history of social movements in San Francisco. And it had been, you know, lost to memory.
Yes, Victor, how did you come into the picture?
Well, I've known Susan for many years, and we started out this process as friends, and we're amazingly enough ending it as friends so far. And but we were sitting around, and I don't know, probably having a drink or something, and saying, hey, yeah, let's make a movie. Yeah, what could we make a movie about? And this story came up as the a really powerful and important story that people hadn't heard that we thought could easily and quickly be made into a film. The reality, of course, is that it's taken us 6 years since that point, so it wasn't quick. But the other parts of it, that it's an extremely moving and important story that very few people remembered at all until Susan rediscovered it in the archives. And so the process of recovering this lost history has been a really powerful experience for me, and I think for everyone involved in the project. So that story and the draw of that story and of being able to get that story across to a wide audience and to large numbers of people about the struggle of these queens for basic dignity was what drew me into the project early on.
Yeah, I think that one of the most interesting aspects of the story is how this one incident lies at the intersection of so many different other events going on. And in the film, you talk about how this happened pretty much in the context of essentially the homophile movement, and then the just sexual gender revolution of the 60s, how influences of like tactics from the civil rights movement came into it. And then also just this being at the intersection of, you know, the poorest area in the city at a time during lots of gentrification, essentially, where the city was interested in kind of moving these people out since it's right there in downtown. And I thought it was very interesting how, like, all these basically people who are like at the intersection of all these different ways of being marginalized because they were poor, because they were transgendered and couldn't find work and were forced into prostitution. And it was very interesting how all of that came together.
Well, one of the things that Susan and I especially brought to the project as historians, we both got our PhD in the same department at Berkeley, which is how we got to be friends. As historians and filmmakers, we bring something different than the usual combination of filmmaker with a historian who comes in and consults, but rather we saw the story and the materials we uncovered in researching the story and the film as a way of illustrating really big, important changes that are about those kinds of intersections. And what was so wonderful about it was that it all came down to that intersection at Turk and Taylor, where there was such an amazing neighborhood that we could use to illustrate both these larger stories of huge events, from the Vietnam War to the changes in the basic way gender operates in our society, to how communities get organized, to acts of resistance, to the very self-identity that these people had, and at the same time talk about it in a way that was about a real place and real people and real people's lives. And that's, I think, one of the things that we've brought to the story that really helps give it a richness that I hope comes across in the film.
Yeah. So the most obvious parallel, and you draw this, you actually mentioned in the film that this incident takes place 3 years before the Stonewall riots in New York City, that a lot of people consider to be a very important turning point for just the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender rights movement. And I was particularly struck by, while they're very similar backgrounds to the story, where they both involve transgendered people kind of being at a riot against police who have been harassing them over quite a long time. The one thing that really struck me was how the outcomes of those two events seemed to be very different. It seemed to me that the outcome of the Turk and Taylor riots was this burst of essentially transgender activism. A lot of different community organizations and work to actually try to help these people who have had such horrible lives and not been able to find work. And it was really centered around the transgender community, and it seemed that the greater gay and lesbian community didn't so much embrace it, where in Stonewall, the opposite seems to have happened, where it was fairly shortly afterwards embraced as being this gay and lesbian turning point. And in fact, so much so that over time, the transgender aspect of Stonewall kind of disappeared from the history books. Would you agree with that, or do you have any thoughts about that?
There are a lot of instructive parallels between Stonewall and the Compton's riot. And whereas Stonewall has been remembered as the beginnings of a gay and lesbian liberation movement, we wanted the story about Compton's to be something different. You know, that you know, I in particular, doing work on transgender history, have been very much aware of how trans concerns are usually marginalized in any history of the movement. And we wanted to tell the story from a transgender perspective, focusing on how transgender people were at the center of what was happening, looking at it, you know, not where gender issues were, you know, just kind of a side issue, but were really, you know, we looked at how that was really the driving force in what was happening, you know, at Compton's, that it was, that was the basis of the oppression that people were suffering, and it's what they mobilized against. One of the big differences, I think, between Compton's and Stonewall is that the outcome of the riot at Compton's was that local activists began to change things at the local level afterwards. They got the police to treat them differently. They were able to deal with getting the city to provide certain kinds of social services, you know, for them. But it did not at that time become the basis of a big mass movement. Mm-hmm. It made some really concrete changes at the local level. Whereas Stonewall, it's like, I think largely because it happened in New York, you know, the center of the known universe. And, you know, there was so much media attention to it. There were just so many more people there. And because it happened a little bit later in the 60s, you know, that I think it took off in a way that Compton's didn't take off. I think by 69, you know, because of the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and stuff, there were a lot of of baby boomers who were very politically mobilized by that time, and they were ready, you know, they were ready for a queer movement in a way that people weren't quite ready for it in 1966. And so even though I think some of the mechanisms were the same between the two riots, you know, they came from similar kinds of issues, that in 1966 in San Francisco, it was like, you know, a spark that fell into some, you know, kindling but didn't light a big bonfire. Whereas in New York 3 years later, you know, they had the gasoline poured and it was ready to go up in flames, you know, when Stonewall happened.
Well, there's another aspect to what Susan was talking about that we discovered in the work on the Compton's riot and the aftermath of it, which is not quite in the same as in with Stonewall. And that isn't, you could say that we surprisingly came up with the defense of liberalism and with liberals in the 1960s, in the sense that what was important, one of the things that was important that happened is that the kind of members of the liberal establishment, whether it was at Glide Church or kind of far-thinking members of the police department, social workers, doctors, were able to respond to the militancy of the Queens in the Tenderloin and to, in a sense, meet them partway. And the Queens were able to really use that. And that's what one of the things that was really important about how the community was able to organize and how the community was able to change some of the really awful conditions that they lived in the sense that there was a response from the larger society. There was possible to get job training paid for by the federal government. It was possible to get programs funded. It was possible to have a church involved in community organizing. Those are new things in 1966. Yeah. Those hadn't been happening before.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they're not happening now. You know, that I think that was probably the most poignant part about making the film, you know, now in the, you know, early 21st century in the political climate that we've been living under recently, that it was heartbreaking in a way to, like, see the president of the United States, you know, Lyndon Johnson, who's not generally remembered as a, you know, progressive force, you know, talking about how we need to end poverty in our society and, you know, looking at, you know, the way the government was saying, like, you know, we're not going to leave anybody behind, you know, and that it was, you know, it was rhetoric to a certain degree then, but there was a substance to the way the government was actually trying to raise the bar, you know, to you know, to better the quality of people's lives. And, you know, as Victor was saying, that the idea that mainstream institutions in society, you know, would do something on behalf of, you know, marginalized, poor, you know, largely people of color, you know, and that they would say, like, no, this is just right and this is just and this is what we would do and, you know, we should do, and that they would try and do the right thing and improve the quality of people's lives. It's like, you don't see that in public discourse in the United States anymore. And it was really sad and shocking to, you know, to realize just how far I think we've fallen from mm-hmm. those kinds of ideals.
Being that you are from first-time filmmakers, what was it that really drew you to making a film, and what were the pleasures and tragedies that may have taken place in the process of making your first film?
Well, Susan and I have this running joke for years that each time something goes wrong, or, you know, we forgot to, you know, get transcripts for something, or, you know, there's some technical issue that comes up, that, well, it's still cheaper than 2 years at USC film school. So we have learned a lot along the way about filmmaking, and that we didn't realize maybe it would have kept us from doing it had we known how challenging and difficult, or that it would take us 6 years to make this movie. But at least I was drawn to making a film about this because, you know, I've published plenty of things as a historian and as an academic, and it has a very narrow audience. I wrote a book with, you know, pitifully small circulation. And when I look at film, when I look at television, and I see the enormous audiences that are out there who are crying out for thoughtful, substantial stories, then that's what drew me into this in a way that I knew that I could take real history, the real solidly researched history, and working with Susan, we could come up with a story that would at once be really entertaining and important and historically accurate and solid. And so that was, in a sense, my inner motivation. Being a first-time filmmaker, there were a lot of mistakes we made along the way, a lot of kind of the, you know, getting lost and doing things wrong and technical problems. And but on the whole, we've been really lucky to come across really great people to work with. People in the filmmaking community in the Bay Area have given so generously of their time and their expertise, with us asking sometimes really stupid questions, or just giving their time to help us make the film, to shoot the film at lower rates than they might normally do, or to help us edit, or to come up with ideas, or to support us with funding, or to, or, you know, especially Jack Walsh, our co-producer, who stepped in at a really crucial moment to help us along the way. So I think that we really benefited from the Bay Area film community, which has a great documentary tradition, and that made it possible to do this. And as well as the support of places like KQED and other institutions that have helped fund us, that they were willing to take a risk with us as first-time filmmakers was really gratifying. Though I have to say, it's been a long time. We've been at it for a while. And if there's one lesson I've learned about filmmaking, is that you just don't give up. That's it. Don't give up.
One of the challenges has been to work in the kind of very, you know, simple language of film, you know, without dumbing down the ideas. I mean, film is really great for being affective and expressive and emotive and visually rich. And you make, you know, you make all kinds of different connections with film than you do with the written word. But the ideas, you know, and the structure of the narrative of film has to be so, you know, so reduced that it's, that's been the challenge. It's been to focus the storyline down in a way. Now, I'll tell one anecdote about Victor and me. When we first started, we were we'd been at it for a couple of years at this point, and we were, you know we'd done a few little demo reels, you know, we were working on, you know, filming our interview subjects. And I was sitting over at his office in Berkeley, and you know, in his office at his house, and there were these bookcases, you know, everywhere. And I was leaning back in a chair, and I just happened to look over at the bookcase, and there were two books next to each other, and one of them was called Eisenstein's Theory of the Montage, and the other one was called How to Budget Your Independent Feature Film. And I pulled them off the shelf and held them up and said, "Now, Victor, which one of these is actually more useful to us?" You know? And well, it's the budgeting book, you know. So it's like that was a good kind of, you know, wake up moment about like what it actually takes to make a film, is to not get lost in the, you know, whatever your, you know, cinephile pleasures are in film watching, but to get down to the nuts and bolts of actually doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been fun. It's been fun to learn the process.
I'm actually interested how, being that this was an incident that took place and then kind of disappeared, how was it that you were able to find the trans women who were originally involved in it? Did you seek people specifically, or did people find you as you were working on the project?
It was a little of both. That I found the document describing it. I tried to, you know, track down people, didn't find much of anything. I met a lot of roadblocks along the way, like, you know, police records that might have described the event no longer exist, and there was no coverage in the mainstream daily newspapers. So I really had to sort of like get out into the community and start looking. And through my archival research, I kind of put together preponderance of evidence sort of case, you know, saying like, well, I think this riot happened pretty much the way that one document described, but, you know, I can't find the smoking gun. I can't find anybody out there who, you know, who remembers it, who was there. I can't, you know, definitively pin down the date. But And that this is about the time that Victor and I were starting to think about making a film. And we initially thought of doing it as kind of a, you know, like almost like a mystery story. You know, it's like, queer historian finds intriguing document. You know, come on, let's go find out if it's true, you know. And it would be kind of like a Michael Moore style, you know, following me around to the, you know, like the city archives and saying, it's like, what do you mean no police records exist? But when we started doing public presentations about this, including at the San Francisco International Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, where we did a kind of a clip and slideshow and lecture about the project that we were doing. Once we started putting the story out into public, people started coming to us. And the best interview subjects were people who came and said, like, oh my God, you're telling the story. I thought everybody had forgotten about it. I thought nobody knew. And people were really, really eager to tell their stories, you know, because it had been important to them and they thought nobody cared. And mm-hmm. it's like that has been probably the greatest reward actually of doing the film is bringing these stories that people care about so much about, you know, their own struggles, you know, bringing that knowledge out into a wider audience and not forgetting it. It's, you know, like I said, I find it really powerful.
So is there anything, so I know that, Susan, you've been a transgender activist for many years now, and both of you, as historians, tell the story of people who are marginalized in one way or another. Is there any specific lesson or take-home message or something that, like, a final thought that you have that you would like to leave people with in addition to seeing the film?
Well, I'll say one thing quickly, and then I'll give Victor the last word, which is that... I think that history is something more than an interesting story that we tell about the past. I think that a critical understanding of your own history is a really important way of being engaged with the present and understanding the deep roots of, you know, the situation that we live in now, and that it is a part of how we work towards building a more equitable and just society. You know, history isn't boring. It's like totally cool. And that, you know, the more you learn about it, the better. And it is a great tool for social activism.
The only thing I would add is that I think the tool that is so clear for me coming out of this story is that these are people who seized an opportunity in a historical opportunity. There was a moment when these different forces, whether it was transsexual surgery or whether it was, you know, federal government money for job training and medical care, or whether it was church activists in their community, or whether it was a wider social acceptance of new kind of gender presentation, they were able to take that for themselves, for changing really, really tough lives that they lived. And that element of it is, I think, the way that history can, that we can learn from this history, and that people now can get a sense that, yeah, you can do this. You can take lives that where you're the most marginalized people in society, at the very bottom, in the toughest neighborhood, in the poorest part of a city where you're about, the buildings are, you know, on their way to being razed, and you can change that. That's the lesson of this story more than any other.
Well, thank you both again. Once again, that was Victor Silverman and Susan Stryker speaking to us about their new film, Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria.